The next case is 04-2004, Gerald Tomasik versus Thomas Tomasik. Justice O'Connor has recused herself in this case. We're pleased to have sitting in place of Justice O'Connor, Judge William Harsha, who's a judge of the Court of Appeals sitting in the 4th Appellate District. Welcome, Judge Harsha.
Thank you, Chief.
Mr. Uphols.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the Court. Mr. Partlow. The appellant wishes to reserve 5 minutes of their allotted time for rebuttal. The facts of this case are not in dispute. The issues before the court concern matters of law. The controversy before the court centers on the interpretation of Section 210776 as amended and effective October 31st, 2001, and the applicability of the time limits contained therein to a class of people or entities generically referred to as other persons. Specific provisions are contained in the relevant statutes for surviving spouses, for those who would inherit under the statute of descent and distribution had the testator died intestate, and all legatees and devisees named in the will. Other people include, but are not limited to, those persons and or charities named in a prior will who have, as in the case at bar, been disinherited as a result of a later will. Also pivotal to the court's determination in this matter is the interpretation of Section 210719 dealing with notice of admission of a will to probate. The evolution of Section 210776, including the most recent amendment, which is the subject of this case, along with the specific legal issues, are thoroughly addressed in the briefs and beyond the scope of oral argument. A short discussion of the various interpretations of the statute should serve to illustrate the complexity of what appears to be an otherwise simple issue. The trial court in this matter interpreted Section 210719 as delineating those persons required to receive notice of probate, to wit, the surviving spouse, those entitled to inherit under the statute of descent and distribution if the testator died intestate, and the legatees and devisees named in the will. The section provides no requirement for notice to other persons. The trial court interpreted Section 210776 as being applicable to anyone filing a will contest, irrespective of whether or not the person was within the class of persons required to receive notice. The court opined on the record that the will contest statute 210773 identifies these other persons as necessary parties, not parties entitled to receive notice pursuant to Section 210719.
Mr. Uphols, let me ask you, when an estate is closed, may there be a challenge to the will following the other than for fraud? Or
it is my understanding, Your Honor, that as we look at the will contest statute, that it does not preclude the filing of a contest of a will even after the estate is closed, which is one of the major concerns that we have here. There's a delineation in the will contest statute where you can prejudge a will to be the last will and testament of the testator. That's normally done in a situation before the person has passed away under a declaratory judgment action. Once a person has passed away and the will goes to probate, I think it's wide open, and I don't believe that there's a limitation of time, which is precisely the concern and issue that we have here.
You haven't found any cases, you didn't cite any cases anyway.
I haven't found any authority otherwise, and the appellee raised this issue in their brief that well, once the will is admitted to probate and the probate is completed and the estate closed, that would preclude anybody from coming in and filing a will contest. Their position is that would require a 60B motion, and we take issue with that. I find no authority for that, and I believe that, in fact, we've seen cases that have been filed after that, which would then require a proceeding against the assets that have been transferred out of the estate. And that really is one of the major concerns that we have in this case, Your Honor. The Court of Appeals...
If we cut right to the issue in the case, it seems to me the issue in this case is legislative intent. Did the legislature, in passing this new version, intend to drop out a limitation for everybody else in the world, but put one on for family? And if the legislature intended that, which I believe is what your opponent is assessing, then we are bound. However, if we find that there is a mistake, which the Court of Appeals seems to even concede when you look at how the bill went back and forth, that it seemed very inadvertent, do we have the power as the court to fix the mistake, even though it is contrary to the plain language of the statute?
Your Honor, I agree that the Court of Appeals looked at this. They found, and I believe rightly so, that this was not the intent of the legislature. They were very clear in their analysis. I think that their analysis was right on point. My complaint with the Court of Appeals is that they did not go beyond that point to rectify the situation. And I believe that not only does this court have the right to do this, but this court has the obligation to do this.
Well, I'm not the best authority on this, but the General Assembly has what they call a corrections bill, mm-hmm. in which it corrects mistakes that it makes. Why shouldn't we let the General Assembly correct this if it's a mistake? Why should we just assume the General Assembly made a mistake? I mean, that argument can be made in many cases where it appears that there's no rationale for the statute. Here, I think, as the appellee says, there is some rationale in that there are certain persons who get notice of the filing of the will. There are many who don't get notice. And so for them to cut off their rights to challenge the will at 3 months seems to be different than cutting off the rights of someone who does have notice.
Your Honor, I think that, first of all, if the legislature intended to correct this, which would be one way of solving this problem, they would have done it by now. They have indicated no intention to do that.
So that would suggest maybe there's no correction to be made, wouldn't it?
That doesn't suggest that to me. I think if we look at...
They just haven't gotten around. They don't know there's a mistake here, I guess.
I think, Your Honor, if we look at the legislative history here, we've got almost 100 years of history along these lines of having all of the people that have an interest in a will being subject to some limitation period. And historically, it's gone from 2 years down to 1 year, down to 4 months, and now down to 3 months. So it's a clear intention of the legislature to move this through the process more quickly, not to keep it open for a longer period of time. And I think that this is a case where if we look at what happened here, there's a clear intention that this was not what the legislature intended to do. When we look at the process here, the legislature was going through a process of redoing some of the probate codes at that time. I think when this was going through the House, they were trying to clean the language up in this particular section that deals with this period of time. And to clean the language up, they took out the reference in the first sentence dealing with the people that were given the notice, which made the language at the end dealing with the other people superfluous, and then they moved that over to the Senate. Now, I think what happened in the Senate is that they took a look at this, and I believe that they felt that in taking out that initial language talking about the requirement to give notice to these three classes of people, if that language was removed, they would take a step backward from what had been done in response to the Palazzi case by this court. So I believe in my best analysis that the Senate wanted to make sure that language in the beginning stayed in the statute, And all they did then was to take the four-month period of time and move it down to three. When it went back to the House then, the House left the initial language in. They forgot to put the language back in about other persons, and I think that that was an unintentional act which eliminated that, at least under some interpretations.
Then to follow up on the Chief Justice's question, this court said in State Ex Rel Sayre versus the Industrial Commission, the rectification of linguistic legislative slippage is generally a legislative function. Mm-hmm. Why isn't that true in this case?
I agree, Your Honor, that it would be the preferred method here to do that. I can tell you that there's been no effort to do that on the part of the legislature. This happened in 2001.
Well, if that's the case, how can you say then what we have here is the clear intent of the legislature? That this is contrary to their clear intent.
Because we can clearly see the process that was conducted in this case from going through the House to the Senate and back to the House. And there it was no indication in any of the things that the House was doing initially that they were doing anything other than cleaning up some of the language and attempting to simplify it. And I truly believe that if it was the intention of the House to change 100 years of history here and remove an entire class of people from the operation of the statute, that they certainly would have said something about that, put something in the various things that they were doing along the lines here, and that it would have been raised as an issue. All the commentators that we hear that have looked at this, people looked at it and thought that the import of this was to change the four-month statute down to 3 months and we'll move on. And that, in fact, is not what happened, because there is the ability now, if you just strictly look at the language here, to say that this entire class of people has now been eliminated, which I think causes a significant detriment to the probate process, which I can't imagine was anything that the legislature intended to do at the time. There is also, Your Honor, a significant case law and authority to say that this court will look to see if there is an absurd or an unintended result, which is what I think we have here, that this court can look to see if there is error on the part of the legislature, and that this court has the ability to come in and correct that, which is what we're asking you to do. I would further say that if, in fact, this court looks at this and says, this is really something that the legislature needs to correct because we can't, then I think that this court, at the very least, needs to send a message to the legislature, like it did in the Palazzi case, that this is a serious and large gap in what's going on here that needs to be corrected. The real issue with respect to these other parties is that they are people that are not surviving spouses. They are people that would not inherit under the statute of descent and distribution. These are not people that are named in the current will as a legatee or devisee. The people that I have just named have 3 months to go and file their will contest action. Yet these other people that are so far removed from this process and who are subject to being disinherited have no statute and no limitation time within which to file their will contest action. And I believe that that really is contrary to the long history under these statutes, and is really detrimental to the administration of the probate process that we've been trying to put forward. If there are no other questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Upholz. Mr. Partlow.
Thank you, Your Honor. Ladies and gentlemen of the court, Michael Partlow here on behalf of the appellee. This case has been extensively briefed all along the way. I do take issue with one statement made by the appellee in that there are facts in dispute in this case. They are not dispositive facts. For example, in the briefing, there is some intimation at this level, anyway, that you know, my clients had all this notice and stuff. That was never found by any court. Frankly, it was never presented to the trial court. There was some brief discussion, and it certainly wasn't the basis of any court's decision. Your Honors, with regard to
Counsel, Justice, if we agree with you, is there anything new for us to write, or would our writings serve simply the purpose of calling to the attention the General Assembly they may or may not have attended to amend the statute in this fashion?
Well, Your Honor, it's a difficult question to answer because, first of all, I did work at a court of appeals once, and I was sort of old school trained, and we all always were told to frown on advisory opinions. On the other hand, I think my second problem in answering that question is, it reminds me of the old commercial, where's the beef? This was enacted in 2000. It became effective in 2001. Within months of it becoming effective, the largest probate journal in the state of Ohio issued a publication explaining all this and explaining why, because there was a case in Cuyahoga County. Yes, there's a long history of the others section, you know, just being there, and people live by it. There was a case in Cuyahoga County where it was challenged.
Well, a reason for the others not having the time limit is they wouldn't have any reason to know about.
Right. This. And there was a Cuyahoga County case that was a due process violation.
If they weren't close to Aunt Jane, they may not even know that Aunt Jane died.
And my point on where's the beef is, since 2000, when we've known about this, the legislature hasn't done anything. Since 2001, when it became effective, you know, it beckons back to the old argument, geez, if you apply the savings statute to will contests, we're going to have chaos in probate courts all over the state. Well, where's the chaos? This is the first case on appeal that's ever addressed this. There can't be chaos. It's just simply not true. And I think from a policy standpoint, if we are going to look at policy, and I would like to address something Justice Stratton said in a moment after I get this in, this is the first time that I can tell this court's ever been asked to do anything like this with regard to a statute of limitations, which in the past the court has always defined as a purely legislative prerogative. And think of the dangers there. I mean, a hot topic in the last 2 years in the state of Ohio, medical malpractice insurance. Well, what's stuff like this going to do to legal malpractice insurance when an attorney picks up a statute on a statute of limitations, reads it, the plain language says, well, this doesn't apply to me or my folks. That's what it says, okay? Then all of a sudden it does because of some perceived problem. Now, do attorneys have to go and research the statutory history of a statute of limitations when they read that and rely on that, or shouldn't they, in that instance especially, be allowed to rely on statutory language, which is clear? Now, Justice Stratton started off with a question about, well, isn't this really about, you know, what did the legislature intend? And I would submit to Your Honor, I would have to disagree with that. No, it's not. Because I think a long history of law in the state of Ohio is, before we even look at legislative intent, we've got to read a statute that's got some kind of a problem. And there's all different kinds of problems statutes can have. They can be ambiguous. They can, the case that we cite in our brief, which I think is particularly illustrative, is the Stanton case, where
your argument would be whether this was intended to be dropped out or whether it was just a mistake. That's not for us to decide. We have a plain language, and if there's a fix, it's the legislators.
If you have plain language, yes. Yes, that is my argument, Your Honor. And you know, like in the Stanton case, the court found, you know, that the word of needed to be inserted for or. It was, in effect, a typo. But that statute that was being looked at absolutely wouldn't work at all. It was impossible to execute, was the language of this court. This statute, when you look at it, is far from impossible to execute. It's easy to execute. There's no nothing on the face whatsoever that shows type of a problem.
I think you disagree with Mr. Uphols on the issue of the what happens when the estate is closed. He's argued in his reply brief, he says we're going to have all these problems because all these estates are subject to being open, or at least attacked in a will contest. What is there any law on this? Is this not?
I believe there is, Your Honor. There's no case law on it. Neither one of us cite any case law, and I do agree with Mr. Uffholtz when he says he hasn't found a case that supports what I've said there. But what I cite the courts to is RC 210776, which says, you know, a predicate for a will contest. Now, a will contest is a very statutory creature. I mean, we're told everything about it in statute. Who's got to be named, blah, blah, blah. And it requires that there's a will being admitted to probate. If there's no will being admitted to probate, if that case is closed, then I would submit to you, is it subject to attack? Sure it is, under Civil Rule 60B. But it's a whole different analysis then. It's a much tougher standard. So the closing of the estate will limit it. And also we've got the default statute of limitations, which is admittedly very long and probably impractical in the application of that to a will contest. I believe it's 10 years. Now, and the point I would like to make, there are several ways to do defaults. I didn't do it extensively. I'm not sure mine's the only one. But whichever other statute in the state of Ohio you would pick as far as limitations periods are concerned, these folks were in time. This was 19 days after the 60 days or 90 days, whatever. I mean, there's nothing, you know, every other statute, they were in time. Now, once again, you know, you go to the default. We don't like that, but that goes to the wisdom of the statute, not to the workability of the statute or the language of the statute or anything like that. One thing that I always remember in this case, two sort of personalities or whatever, and these are not people I know personally, stick out though. One, if you'll notice from the trial court record, we had Judge Klunk sitting by assignment. I have no problem with Judge Klunk. I'm not here to disparage the man. I had other cases with him years ago, but I'm not sure. He was a retired judge because the Summit County judge had a conflict here. He was assigned by this court to sit on it. I'm not sure he ever actually operated under this new statute. I believe his retirement was right around that. The other thing, person that sticks out is on the Court of Appeals, one of the justices or one of the judges said, you know, I used to be on the state legislature. We'd pass stuff all the time that we didn't like a year later or 2 years later or 3 years later, but that's our right. That's our legislative function. As long as it's clear and as long as the courts can apply it, then that, you know, it may be stupid. I believe that was the word he used. And we've all seen statutes that probably fell into that category, but that's the legislative prerogative, Your Honors. Frankly, Your Honors, I believe I've put forth most of the points I've had. I know the court's had a long morning. I would like to make one comment. I sat through all the arguments today, and I certainly don't follow the court that closely and come in and listen to arguments just in my leisure. But today, at least, there seemed to be this theme about, you know, when should the court put language into a statute or a constitution that isn't there, or when should the court, you know, impose a burden of proof that has never been established via legislation or otherwise. And I just thought it was interesting that that sort of theme seemed to be coming forth. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Partlow. Mr. Uffholtz, you saved a little more than a minute of your time.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. First of all, with respect to the trial judge, I think that he had a great deal of insight into this matter. If you look at the transcript there, he talked about the Palazzi case. He, in fact, looked at the statute, and if we want to say that on its face it's very plain and clear to everybody, he looked at the statute with the time limitations in it and said, I believe that statute applies to everybody, not just these three classes of people. And I believe that when we talk about the notice statute, that was the purpose of that, is to make sure that these three classes of people get notice. So I have a trial judge who sat on the bench for a long time looking at a statute and saying it wasn't clear. The problem with the statute is if you just look at it, it appears on its face to be clear, but I do not believe that it reflects what the legislature intended to do, and I do not believe that we actually have a situation here where the legislature intended to change a long history of what was going on. The real issue that's not before this court today deals with these other persons and whether they have a constitutionally protected right to receive notice of a case going through, and this court touched upon that in the Palazzi case. I think in response to this court touching upon that in the Palazzi case, this notice statute was put into place to deal with these three protected classes of people. The point that we haven't gotten to yet is what do we do to determine if these other persons have a constitutional right because of the possibility of being disinherited, and now how do we give them notice if they're entitled to get notice? The state of the law right now is that they're not entitled to get
notice. You've used your time, you need to sum up quickly.
And I think that that's a point that we're going to need to look at in the future, but it's not before the court today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. The marshal will please adjourn court.
All rise.